matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Night after night in the dark I'm alone, so find me a match of my own.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. If I Were a Rich Man, sunrise, sunset, tradition. From Broadway productions to high school performances, Fiddler on the Roof has captivated audiences around the world for 50 years. The story of a poor Jewish family in Russia at the turn of the last century would seem at first glance to have limited commercial appeal. And in fact, the show almost didn't get made because theater producers in the early 60s couldn't see how they'd sell enough tickets to Gentiles. But the show did get made, and the rest is, well, history. And a compelling history it is. In Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof, author Elisa Solomon takes us from the original Sholem Aleichem stories the musical was based on to the most recent revivals of the show on Broadway. Solomon was in Milwaukee not long ago to read from her book, and she joined us in the studio then. Elisa, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Fiddler on the Roof, such an amazing thing, almost 50 years old now, the musical, not the stories that it came from. What is it about this musical and about these stories of Tevye that managed to somehow capture the world? Because they are so specifically Jewish of a particular time that actually didn't even really exist in the stories.
It's such a good question, and it was really the animating question of my work on this book. There's a lot of answers. It spoke very specifically to the Jewish American experience in the mid-1960s. The show opened, as you say, nearly 50 years ago in September 1964. And this was a moment of great turmoil in the United States. The civil rights movement was very active and also starting to confront the limits of liberalism. The women's movement was gaining a lot of steam. Fiddler went into rehearsals just as the feminine mystique had come out. There was so much going on that the show reflects of that American moment and does so through this story specifically about Jews of Eastern Europe in the Pale of Settlement. And it's a story very much about change, about how a family is trying to deal with all of these kinds of forces of history that are creating changes to the community, to the family structure, to the ethos, to the possibility of maintaining some old ways. These are all the kinds of things that America was dealing with in that moment, and Jewish America too, both in that general sense and in also a very specific communal sense. The community was very concerned in the 60s about what they took to be the threat of interfaith marriage. You know, now that anti-Semitism was not such a threat in the United States as it had been in earlier decades, and Jews were having access to universities and jobs and social situations and housing, neighborhoods, you know, all kinds of things that had been closed to them before. Now that those threats were not so dangerous, they were starting to worry about the threats from within. Now that they had all this access, now that they could mingle, now that their kids could go to any university, now their kids were meeting all kinds of kids and marrying them. And so now the threat was coming from inside the community, which is reflected in those Tevye stories as well. So both in the general American way and in the very specific Jewish American way, the themes of the show spoke very directly. And then, of course, had wider universal appeal, as those concerns about generational conflict, the sustaining of tradition in the face of change, and so on, belong to really any culture whatsoever.
You made a really interesting comment at one point where you said that Fiddler gave post-McCarthy American Gentiles the Jews they could love and wanted to love, which I found really interesting because, of course, when you move it 30 or 40 years ahead, people were saying, well, it's either not Jewish enough or too Jewish. You know, it's like the show was straddling those concerns as well in the greater culture.
Mm-hmm. So you refer to the McCarthy period, and Fiddler comes out of a moment when the McCarthy period is really over. And there's, you know, I think a big sigh of relief generally in the United States, but especially in the Jewish community. There was a taint of Jewish community as being communist, inaccurately, But there was a lot of anxiety in the organized Jewish community during the Red Scare period. There were purges of leftists from Jewish organizations. The American Jewish Committee actually supported the execution of the Rosenbergs. There was just a lot of nervousness, and many, many Jewish artists, including Zira Mostel, who starred in Fiddler, were blacklisted. And other members of the company, namely Jerome Robbins, the director and choreographer, had named names before the House Un-American Activities Committee. One of several reasons, that there was a lot of tension between those two geniuses. So in the early 1960s, when the authors start working on the show, I think it's a moment when Jews are ready to come out of the closet. You know, there was a big push in the 50s for the Jewish community to be saying, we're just like everyone else. We are full-blooded Americans. So even the tercentenary celebration of Jews in America in the mid-50s was a celebration of American democracy, this almost year-long series of events that were organized all over the country. And hardly any mention of Jewish identity or Jewish practice or anything remotely like that. It was all about the assertion that we belong completely to the American culture. And I think part of that is a response to the accusation of communist taint. So by the 60s, that's finally over. And even though the creators of Fiddler didn't realize it at the time, and some producers that they took the script to, you know, exactly wondered if the show would be popular, you know, one of them famously said, well, this is all very nice, but who's going to buy tickets once we run out of Hadassah groups? They didn't recognize that Jewish audiences and other audiences were ready to recognize, yes, that Jews are solid members of the American polity in every way, full citizens in every respect. And that means that their heritage and their difference can now be recognized and celebrated.
And somehow that becomes universal, that immigrant experience is one that all people or most people here shared.
This was a moment, too, when the way America was thinking about itself and its history was changing. The immigration policy was changing in the 60s. The idea of America as a nation of immigrants became a primary way in which we talked about ourselves as a nation.
Really, that was first. That was the first time we were really thinking that way?
Other people had said such things before, but as a really defining idea, a common idea, a widely accepted idea, something that presidents were talking about. Social historian Matthew Fry Jacobson writes about these kinds of issues, and I like the way he describes this moment. He says the locus of the American origin story around this time shifted from Plymouth Rock to Ellis Island.
Let's talk about the show itself, because as you said, Jerome Robbins, who is a wonderful choreographer and American director, West Side Story, I'm thinking, all kinds of other things, Zira Mostel, very famous. And the story that you tell of getting the thing to stage is amazing. I mean, most shows have some kind of like, oh, my God, tearing your hair out in the back wings. But this was amazing that it ever got onto the stage at all.
In a way, I guess, but I think it was destined for glory from the beginning. But I had a lot of fun doing the research and trying to recreate what it was like in those rehearsal rooms. So, you know, starting with the various drafts of the scripts early on and Jerome Robbins sending his notes to the librettist Joseph Stein and to the composer and lyricist Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick and starting to hammer it into shape before they rehearsed it, and then the audition process, and then rehearsals in New York, and then taking it on the road in to Detroit, and then Washington, D.C., before it came to New York. And all along the way, changes being made. I mean, the show never changed its general shape or focus, but internally there were huge changes. There were, you know, songs that seemed to be great songs, and some of them actually are recorded and you can find them and listen to them. Others are in archives at the Library of Performing Arts in New York. Songs just like thrown out, you know. New songs written in hotel rooms while they were on the road. Fights in rehearsal. The show-stopping number in the wedding scene, the bottle dance, wasn't put into the show till the very last minute. Jerry Robbins was kind of secretly working on it and put it into the show in Washington, I think just about 2 weeks before they were coming to open in New York. And thank God, because that's such a great, great dance.
What an amazing scene it is. And you think that, oh, the show almost didn't have that. Did people in the cast and crew and, you know, design team that you talked to, did they have any sense that this was going to be the cultural icon that it became?
None at all.
It was just another show.
It was just another show for a while. And in Detroit, you know, they were working so hard on the road, and Robbins was quite a taskmaster, and they would perform at night, rehearse all day, perform at night, rehearse all day, and they were all exhausted and ragged, and he never let good, you know, well enough alone. They were probably too exhausted to even see what beautiful shape it was coming into. But they started to feel it in Washington. You know, after they'd played some weeks in Detroit, moved on to Washington, there were lines around the block for tickets. That had to be because of word of mouth. You know, there hadn't been local press yet, and they started to get very strong ovations and receptions, and they started to have a sense that, okay, you know, we're going to be employed for a while. That's good. But that it would have that iconic status nobody could have imagined. That came as a shock even to the creators.
And then you fast forward 40 years to the revival in 2004, the one that Alfred Molina starred in, and then Harvey Fierstein took over Tevye for. And you know, the show had taken on this amazing, I don't know, it's like we all own it.
We all own it and we fight over it.
You know, yeah, like families do.
Yes, exactly. You know, who else is allowed to do it? Is it authentic enough? Is a particular actor doing it the right way? All those kinds of questions come to the fore and reveal our own moment, I think. So when there was a controversy over the 2004 revival, there were some critics who were complaining that it wasn't, you know, so-called Jewish enough, which is, you know, kind of ironic. I mean, here the original producers or original potential producers were turning down the property, saying it's too Jewish. And now 40 years later, you know, some people are saying, well, it's not Jewish enough. So exactly, you know, what happened? How did this work turn into a kind of folklore in the meantime and become something that all of us own and all of us look to for different reasons? And in the case of some of those critics, they look to Fiddler for their own Jewish identity and they expect it to stay the same. It became the tradition that wasn't allowed to change.
Do you think it will continue to ask of us what tradition means and what roots mean and what our generational differences mean, no matter whether we're Jewish or not?
I think it will. I mean, I think that's at the heart of it. And it's actually at the heart of the original stories by Shlomo Aleichem that the show is based on. And that's part of why it has that power. It sustains that power. Those questions and concerns are embedded in the very source material and in the figure of Tevye, who is very much an on the one hand, on the other hand kind of guy, both how he reasons things through and how we experience him in this really dialectical place between holding on to something, letting go of something, between stasis and change, between the old and the new, and so on.
Alisa, it has been such a pleasure having you in the studio this morning. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Alisa Solomon is the author of Wonder of Wonders, A Cultural History of Fiddler on the Roof. Solomon was a theater critic for the Village Voice from 1983 to 2004, and she also contributed to the New York Times and The Nation, among other publications. She currently teaches at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, where she directs the Arts and Culture Concentration in the MA program. Solomon appeared at Boswell Book Company recently, and she spoke with us then. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.